any questions?
Does wisdom destroy duality?
Duality never existed. It destroys it destroys the grasping at duality. Okay, when it destroys the afflictive obscurations, and when that wisdom removes the cognitive obscurations, it destroys the appearance of duality. Okay. Yeah.
This is a question. I debate people online a lot about Buddhist philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
And this guy is always talking about this, because things are empty, they're all perfect. Because they're not, there is no duality.
Mm-hmm.
So if happiness is equally empty and not dual to suffering, then what motivation is there to remove suffering if it's equally perfect and happiness?
Okay, so if everything is perfect because it's empty, then why try and eliminate suffering and have happiness because everything's perfect already? You know, we Westerners love to throw around this word perfect. You know, we love it. Yeah. Oh, everything's perfect. Everything's empty. There's no good. There's no bad. Everything's perfect. I'm in la la land. Okay? You know, if you're highly realized, you can say that and understand what it really means. But most of us who talk like that, we don't really get it. Okay? I remember, because this comes up in terms of Tantra a lot. You know, there's no good, there's no bad, there's no pure, there's no impure. And so, that's why people are saying, oh yes, you know, you can go and have a consort and there's no desire and it's all transformed and you can go and hunt because there's no inherently existent hunting, there's no inherently existent killing, there's no good, there's no bad, so all these things are like okay because they're perfect, right? Yeah? Right? Right? You can drop some bombs on somebody because it's all empty. There's no good. There's no bad. Yeah. Okay? From the viewpoint of somebody who has the direct perception of emptiness, while they are resting in the meditation on emptiness, there's no appearance of conventional objects at all. So when you're meditating on emptiness, there's no appearance of good or bad or this or that or anything. Okay, there's just emptiness appearing. Okay. Does that mean on a conventional level that there's no good and there's no bad? No, it doesn't mean that on a conventional level. Because the understanding of emptiness should support respecting karma. Okay? It's very important because if an understanding of emptiness leads somebody to disrespect the functioning of cause and effect, then they say that's the fast ticket to the hell realm. Because if you think there's no cause and effect because it's all empty, then you do whatever you want and you think it's all okay. But that person is confusing conventional truth and ultimate truth. Okay? On an ultimate level, nothing inherently exists. But on a conventional level, things exist and they function. Okay? So if you really understand that and you understand that things are empty, but they also dependently arise, then your keeping of ethical conduct becomes meticulous. Okay? Now it's true, there might be a highly realized being who, like Tilopa, you know, he could, when Naropa first met him, Tilopa was a fisherman and he was killing fish. He was frying live fish in a pan and then eating them. He was some dirty, scummy looking guy, you know, and Naropa found him. And there's Tilopa frying this fish in a pan. And, you know, it looks totally like, I mean, what kind of practitioner is this? Frying live fish and eating them, he's dirty and, you know, everything like that. Well, Tilopa had perfect understanding of emptiness. His mind had no ignorance. He had no attachment. He was not killing those fish out of attachment to eating them. He was not killing them out of anger because he couldn't stand them. So he had a totally pure motivation. And after he fried them, he made them go back to life again. Okay?
What was his motivation at frying them?
I think he was, for the benefit, his motivation for frying them, I think it was for the benefit of his disciple or disciple to be Naropa, because Naropa was grasping at true existence. Okay? And so sometimes teachers, to jar their students out of their incredible attachment to this or that, then they do these crazy wisdom things, okay? But the teacher from their side has absolutely no negativity, you know? And in the end, there's no long-term damage, okay, that's given. So I remember in a conference with His Holiness, it's 1993, and, you know, there were some of these scandals going on in the Buddhist community with teachers sleeping with their students. And His Holiness is always commenting that they seem to sleep with the young, attractive students. You know, they don't sleep with... Because in the scriptures, you know, Vajrayogini manifested as an old hag. You know, this is also in Naropa's case. You know, he's a Vajrayogini practitioner. And... you know, when he was there grasping an inherent existence, this old hag came along and said, look, you know, you don't have the realizations you think you have. You need to go off and meet Tilopa. Okay, that was actually Vajrayogini. Yeah. Manifesting as the old hag. Anyway, His Holiness was commenting that all these teachers who do this seem to not have any old hags. But just the young, beautiful women, you know, and that people who have also reached this level, it said, you know, whether they have riches or don't have riches, their mind is completely equal, you know, totally equal. But it's very curious how most of these teachers seem to side on the side, go to the side of having the riches and the wealth. You know, if your mind's really equal and untainted by ignorance, how can they always go to that side? How come they don't go to the side of, you know? And then His Holiness is saying, you know, somebody who's really at that level, who really understands that, for them, eating some sumptuous dinner and eating poo or poop is exactly the same. So Bob Thurman suggested the taste test. On how to see which of these teachers really sees everything as perfect. Yeah? So for all these people, yes, it's all perfect, it's all perfect. Okay, well, let's do the taste test. How perfect it is for you. Okay? Because, you know, in the West we throw this kind of language around so much because it sounds great. We're so addicted to this, you know, wonderful sounding language. Yeah? Anything to get us out of keeping, you know, good morality. Isn't it? anything to cut us some slack so we can have what our ego wants. But, yeah. So, His Holiness was also commenting, you know, because you asked about why Tilopa was doing that, you know, and somebody could say, well, why did Naropa follow him? And His Holiness said, you know, when the teacher and the disciple are both highly realized, you can have this kind of conduct and it becomes an extremely skillful way for leading the disciple. But then he looked at us and he said, but if you don't have that realization and your teacher doesn't have that realization, don't think you can act like that. Okay.
So,
yeah?
When we say that the Buddhas are in happiness and bliss, mm-hmm. That's just us saying that they are so ignorant or something?
Well, when we say the Buddhas are in happiness and bliss, it is happiness, it is bliss, but it's conventionally existent, it's not inherently existent.
Okay, good.
You know?
Okay.
Yeah. For a Buddha, you know, when they perceive emptiness, in the state of emptiness, there's no difference between happiness and suffering because everything is empty of inherent existence and you're just focused on that emptiness. And that empty, focusing on that emptiness eliminates the causes of your suffering, so it eliminates your suffering. Okay, but Buddhists certainly recognize that for sentient beings, on a conventional level, happiness and suffering exist. Okay. But happiness and suffering exist relative, because what we consider suffering from the perspective of a being born in the hell realm would be bliss. Okay? What we consider suffering for that level being, you know, for a hell realm being, is nothing. They would be delighted to have what we call suffering. Okay? So everything that shows that suffering doesn't have an inherently existent nature, or that some experience doesn't have an inherently existent nature, depends on who you are and how you're looking at it and everything else. Okay? But on a conventional level in our human realm, you know, we give things names that function only on the conventional level. Okay? Mm-hmm.
I have a question on Buddhism. We talk about Buddhism as bodhisattvas and imagine them being all around us.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly we're encouraged to receive that support and encouragement from their mind training. I'm wondering exactly how those beings who have gone to be a Buddha, who aren't incarnated at this moment, in what way, how does their consciousness, or does it in any way directly connect with our consciousness or influence it in any way? How exactly do they influence sentient beings on this realm that most of us live?
Okay.
And not in some other area.
So how do all the Buddhas, especially those who aren't appearing on the earth at this time, actually influence us in a positive way? Okay. Well, I'm not well versed in the exact dependently arising dynamics of how it happens. However, it seems to me that our mind is something that's very powerful. Okay? And it would make sense to me that there's various ways for beings to communicate and influence each other. I mean, we influence others by our words, we influence them by our actions, but it would seem possible that there may be a way to influence by the mind as well. So especially if you have that kind of pure mind, you know, there might be a way to influence somebody else's mind in some dependently arising technique. Now, how open we obscure beings are to their influence is another ballgame. Okay? Because when our mind is very obscured, we make it really hard on the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas to help us. You know, they say that it's like, you know, their help, their inspiration or their blessing is like the sun shining. The sun shines everywhere. The pot's upside down. Nothing gets inside the pot. The sun is still shining everywhere, but the pot makes it really difficult to get sun inside because it's upside down. So this is why we do purification practices. We're trying to creep this pot slowly and, you know, lift it so a little bit of sunshine can get in there. Mm-hmm. Yeah?
So as we do that, then we become more receptive to what's already present in the airport.
Yes. Yes, we make ourselves more receptive. And you can see this just in a relative way. Like, you know, like some people go to His Holiness's teachings and say, wow, what an incredible person. And other people go and say, what in the world is this guy talking about? You know? And you can just see there's different levels of receptivity. Yeah, and that's one way we can just see quite directly, can't we? Yeah. Hmm. Susan, you had a question?
Yeah, I hope I can formulate it clearly. Here we are, little by little by little, getting some insight about compassion, practicing trying to feel it,
mm-hmm.
Almost like acting.
Mm-hmm.
And then from the Buddhist side, it seemed to me that with that realization of emptiness, seeing the grasping, clinging ignorance about the nature of reality, that really triggers the compassion.
Mm-hmm.
And so that fullest sense of the compassion is based on seeing the suffering caused by that ignorance, inability to understand reality.
That's what this compassion is all about.
And so how we get there is just this little thing.
Yeah,
uh-huh.
That's it. We're just chugging along.
And then bingo.
Well, it's not really bingo. Okay. Oh, no, there is one other point to bring in here.
Uh-huh.
That there's what they call modest faculty disciples and sharp faculty disciples. Okay? So we all want to be the sharp faculty. Yeah, we want to be the modest faculty. And this has to do with in what order somebody generates compassion or bodhicitta and wisdom. So there's some disciples who put a lot of energy into generating bodhicitta first. Yeah, they have a lot of faith in the Dharma, faith in their teacher, faith in the Triple Gem. Yeah, and on the basis of this strong faith, then they do the practice to generate bodhicitta first, and they enter the bodhisattva path that way. And of course, they do some meditation on emptiness, you know, as they're going along, but their principal emphasis is bodhicitta. And then after they have spontaneous bodhicitta and they've actually entered the first path of the bodhisattva, the path of accumulation, then they start really focusing more and more and more and more on realizing emptiness. And their progression, their understanding of emptiness deepens as they progress along the bodhisattva path. So that's one way of doing it. That's for the disciples who have modest faculties.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, for the sharp faculty disciples, before they even enter the bodhisattva path of accumulation, the first bodhisattva path, they will meditate on emptiness and get some realization of it. Not a direct realization, probably a conceptual realization. And through the power of that, and with that power of that realization of emptiness, they've been meditating on bodhicitta all along too. It's not like somebody only does one practice and not the other. But they focus more on getting the realization of emptiness, and then they bring that to their meditation on bodhicitta, and then generate spontaneous bodhicitta with which they enter into the bodhisattva's first path. And so this is for somebody who hasn't attained arhatship at first. Okay, so that person is called a sharp faculty disciple. Yeah. And so we can see the development of this compassion. Some people, when they enter the bodhisattva path, will have only the first compassion seeing sentient beings. Some might have the first and second compassion, also adding the compassion seeing phenomena. Some, the sharp faculty disciples, are going to have all three compassions, because they'll see sentient beings as qualified by emptiness, and on that basis generate bodhicitta. Yeah?
It just seems to me that if you were to meditate on emptiness, that could, and directly realize that, or even a conceptual realization, that would generate so much bliss.
Mm-hmm.
That might be really hard to.
Yeah, to look at sentient beings.
Yeah.
Yes, that's why they. Her question was, you know, it seems if you realized emptiness, you'd have so much bliss that, like, who wants to meditate on compassion for sentient beings? And that is why we are recommended to enter the bodhisattva vehicle from the beginning, because this is exactly what happens to those who enter the hearer and solitary realizer vehicles from the beginning. Is, you know, they're bowled over by the bliss of liberation, and it's hard to go back and generate the great compassion in the bodhicitta. Yeah, so that's why they really encourage us in the very beginning to, you know, meditate on emptiness and bodhicitta in tandem. Okay, so let's sit quietly and meditate.